I suppose just a little bit of background first on the paper. As part of my research into the United Irish League in Cork, one of the best sources for it would be local newspapers. In this respect, so you have the Southern Star, but you also have the Skibbereen Eagle. Now, for various reasons, the Skibbereen Eagle hasn't been widely available, except on microfilm, but Irish newspaper archives have started digitising runs of it, so there's now a run of, I think, almost 20 years of it from 1900 to 1922. I think there's 2 years missing. So it's a part of a larger project in looking into the Eagle and looking into its coverage of both the United Irish League and the All for Ireland League later on. So this paper just happens to come out of it. So apologies for the impressionism that may come for it. So loyalism, unionism and conservatism are tropes that have long overlapped in the history of Ireland in the 19th and early 20th centuries. On many occasions they are used interchangeably or as convenient shorthand for describing complex political outlooks held by a shrinking cohort within Irish society at the dawning of the new century. Yet they were also separate political identities and crossed not only confessional boundaries but also encroached into the blocks of nationalism which inhabited the island of Ireland at the end of the Victorian era. And I think Tim Wilson, in his keynote, touched on some of this yesterday. Certainly it is true that these identities were of a minority taste. However, it is equally valid to suggest that insights offered by the press suffused by these ideologies shed a different hue of light on the monolithic political and social blocks. It is furthermore valid to state that a number of newspapers mirrored their nationalist counterparts in arguing for a conservative Irish polity either within or outside the empire. This continuity of conservatism survived the waning of loyalism and unionism as active political movements in much of Ireland. Inasmuch as it is reductionist to speak of a Protestant loyalism, it is as reductionist to speak of a conservative unionism or loyalism. So this paper focuses on one such newspaper, the Skibbereen Eagle, or to give it its more official and grandiose moniker, the County Cork Eagle and Munster Advertiser. From approximately the end of the Victorian era until its closure in 1922, the Eagle fought a brave rearguard action on behalf of loyalism and unionism as the nationalist tide swelled around its hinterland of western County Cork. Yet it also found itself in harmony with a number of nationalist newspapers in preaching conservatism in many areas of social and economic life. So just a very quick background into the Eagle. It was founded in 1859 by the Potters, who were immigrants from Wales. It consisted of four sheets originally. It expanded out to eight sheets in the 1880s or 1890s. For much of the period covered by this paper, it had eight pages plus a supplement varying in length depending on the news of the week. If there were certain news events that needed to be covered in depth, they might have gone on for a four-page supplement or maybe more. So just a quick sketch of the hinterland of the Eagle. So you can see here most of the main towns in County Cork, and a few villages as well thrown in for good measure. So the paper's base was in Skibbereen, so here. It also had an office in Bandon. And for most of its time, it covered news from Kinsale, Clonakilty, Dunmanway, Castledownbere, or Bearhaven. They were the main, and Bantry to a certain extent. Its competitor, the Southern Star, which was founded in 1889, expanded, had a wider base. The Eagle also covered Cork City, but not until later in the time. The Eagle's competitor, the Southern Star, went on to include news from Ballincollig and Macroom, so it had a slightly wider hinterland than the Eagle. So, just moving on. Yeah, so this community of loyalism reflected in the pages of the Eagle was malleable. Over the final two decades of its existence as a newspaper, the old bird trumpeted a conservatism well within the taste of its readership, while subtly alluding to the loyalism of not just the unionist community centred on the towns of Skibbereen and Bandon, but also the nationalist community, especially after 1910, those who vocally supported the IPP and its chairman John Redmond here on your right. Conservatism was not just the preserve of the local newspapers or magistrates, whose activities were chronicled faithfully in the pages of the paper. From 1898 The expansion and democratisation of local government brought a new scion of the population into the rate-paying umbrella, whose tax money was used to fund the new urban, rural and county councils. A watchful eye needed to be kept on the uses of abuses of this money, as we've heard in Ciarán's paper already. And the paper's one of the paper's founders, Fred Potter, took it upon himself to act as a watchdog, pointing out cases where he saw misuse of money and, more importantly, putting in forward solutions that would see the prudent use of public money. After the death of its eccentric founder in 1906, the Eagle came under the control of a local nationalist cadre. In the internecine nationalist struggle of 1909 to 1914, the Eagle took the side of William O'Brien, as you can see here on your left, William O'Brien's All for Ireland League, against the monolithic Irish Parliamentary Party. Yet during and after the First World War, the Eagle switched sides and opposed Sinn Féin, which subsequently led to its suppression in 1920 and its eventual closure 2 years later. Prudence and moderation were but two themes that the Eagle perched on again and again throughout the two decades surveyed in this paper. These themes intersected neatly with many teachings of the Catholic Church, and many articles and column inches were taken up as the decades moved on, detailing prognostications poured forth from various altars in the Eagle's hinterland of West Cork. Lenten pastorals from the local bishops were given due space, and indeed sat side by side with reports from Church of Ireland vestries and Methodist meetings, though the latter declined in frequency as the years went on. Surprisingly, or perhaps not, was the patronage bestowed upon the Eagle by Bishop Denis Kelly of Ross, whose cathedral was located in Skibbereen. You can see Kelly here on your left. Yet this was not as much a surprise as it appears to modern-day readers, as a series of complex events and personality clashes brought it about. Monsignor John O'Leary, who you can see on your right here, was parish priest of Clonakilty and a folk hero in West Cork during the years of the Land League, where he clashed with the powerful local landlord William Bence Jones of Lissalan House just outside the town. O'Leary was no fan of Potters either, to put it mildly, and when the O'Sullivan brothers, former employees of the Eagle offices, established a new paper in Skibbereen, the Southern Star, O'Leary brought together a consortium to assume ownership of the title in 1892. Having taken the pro-Parnell side in the split which physically and psychologically damaged Irish nationalism in 1890 to 91, O'Leary was overlooked for the vacant bishopric of Ross in 1897 in favour of Kelly. Animosity was therefore not in short supply, and the Star and the Eagle clashed on numerous occasions over the coming decades. Potter on one occasion referring to the new owner as owners of the paper as, quote, blackleg capitalists who, while professing anxiety for national liberty, only wished the liberty to tyrannise over others. This defensiveness, allied to the hyperbole expressed in this outburst, was perhaps characteristic of the man who warned the Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, the year before, that the Eagle was keeping a watchful eye on him. Potter's editorial style was given to hyperbolic outbursts and preaching to his flock in the style of a pastor delivering a sermon. For example, in January 1901, he poured forth on the subject of local councils tendering for contracts to construct houses for rural labourers and also for the maintenance of local roads. And I quote, "The experience of the past 2 years has shown that many of the contractors who tender at ridiculously small sums have not the slightest intention of ever performing their contract. The lesson is obvious. Of course, it is not suggested or even insinuated that the lowest tender should be positively declined. Common sense should suggest a happy medium. Unprincipled and corrupt contractors should receive no mercy. If the county and district councils succeed in cleansing the road contract system of jobbery, they will have secured an undoubted boon for the country. They have the power in their own hands if they wish to exercise it." End quote. Mention of labour and the position of labouring people in West Cork brings me to the treatment of the subject of labour by the Bird. Potter's writings on the subject are numerous and varied, all the more so following the passage of a Labourers' Act in the House of Commons in 1896, which brought more responsibility upon the organs of local government for the welfare of working people in their respective catchment areas. His attitude can be described as that of a paternal landlord, not uncommon at the time, who offered advice and defended the class against the ravages of the advancing middle class. In this respect, it was not uncommon for a middle-aged printer and publisher, amongst other things, to be defending his territory, so to speak. While the labouring classes could hardly afford a weekly copy of the Eagle, which was priced at 1 penny in 1900, though in 1921 and 1922 it rose to 2 pence, and while the literacy rates were below average amongst this class, nevertheless the readership of the Bird were defenders of the status quo, and perhaps more benign in their views on the labour movement, which they did not see as threatening their social and economic hegemony. This viewpoint was counteracted in the pages of the Star, especially during the tumultuous two-year editorship of D.D. Sheehan, you can see here on your left, co-founder of a new labour organisation, the London Labour Association, in 1894. Sheehan saw the potential for a counter to the hegemony wielded by those denizens who took the preachings from Potter's Watchtower. The Watchtower, which was the heading over the editorial in the Eagle, was actually a physical tower which was constructed at the back of the Eagle offices just off Bridge Street in Skibbereen, and survived up to, I think, the 1970s before it was demolished. So moving on. Both papers, ironically, took similar views to the spread of the new nationalist political organisation, the United Irish League, into their hinterland at the opening of the 20th century. In the run-up to the general election of October 1900, Potter advanced the causes of sitting MP Edward Barry, here on your left, in South Cork, and Bandon businessman John P. Walsh, here on your right, in South East Cork, railing against the proposed selection of, quote, sponging adventurers and empty-headed spouters, end quote, and declaring that, should either constituency organisation, or divisional executive, to use the UIL's lingua franca, look outside the county or the country for a candidate, then, quote, they do not deserve home rule, end quote. Potter's relationship with the term home rule could be charitably described as turbulent. On another occasion in 1901, he thundered against the decision of the Skibbereen Urban Council to deny the use of the town hall to the promoters of a flower show. This was in protest at the decision by one of the committee, a local Church of Ireland clergyman and squireen landlord, not to renew the lease on a farm on the outskirts of the town. Potter took aim in particular at the comments of the local UIL leader, Timothy Sheehy. And you can see the quote here. Home rule or self-government is a noble cause, a natural right that every nation should possess. But every lover of pure liberty must feel disgusted with such petty acts of low tyranny. It would be interesting to know, would Mr. Sheehy cheerfully forfeit his legal right to his property? And if not, would the Urban Council be justifying in refusing the use of the town hall to any number of persons who are anxious to discuss the scandalous and dangerous sanitary condition of Skibbereen, or the insulting offer of £5 a year to the sanitary medical officer, although Mr. Sheehy originally suggested £15 and was the proposer of £10? Then, at the next meeting, after all the praise he previously lavished on the doctor, forced the £10 down to £5. Consistency, where art thou? Oh, would the power gifty give us to see ourselves as others see us. God save Ireland, Gavora Dieran. Another famous example was he railed against home rule after tripping over some paving stones outside his office that were laid either for a footpath or were intended to be crushed up to be used as paving for the road. So he was a little idiosyncratic, I think is the kind phrase. But as was common among journals printed and published outside of the metropoles, it was the question of land use and ownership which most exercised the mind of Potter and his contemporaries less than half a mile across town. The Eagle championed the work of Horace Plunkett, here on your left, and the Irish Agricultural Cooperative Society, and cautiously welcomed the agitation led by T.W. Russell, here on your right, in Ulster, in favour of compulsory purchase of land by the state. Potter was something of a polyglot when it came to the land question. Columns were frequently written in the early years of the 20th century, with excerpts from writings by Henry George, here on your left, the American political economist and journalist whose writings influenced Michael Davitt later on. H.W. Massiam, here in the middle, the British radical journalist, former editor of the Daily Chronicle and the Nation newspapers. James McCann, MP, on the far right, who was MP, stockbroker, businessman in Dublin. He owned Simmons Court Castle in Donnybrook and also much of Navan Town in County Meath, and others. With the commencement of a strike at the Cork Gasworks in late 1901, Potter ran a series of articles on the compulsory prevention of strikes, thus proving himself no friend of organised labour. No friend was he of the Liberal Party in Britain either, enjoying the fact that its chief press organ, Reynolds Newspaper, condemned all of the British press as fraudulent while failing to recuse itself from that list. Loyalty to the Empire and its constituent parts was quite noticeable among the plumage of the Eagle. At the turn of the 20th century, the Boer War was covered extensively by the paper, with news from wire services prominent on the front page of most issues. Attention was drawn to those from the hinterland of the paper, who served with valour and distinction during the war, many of them in the Royal Munster Fusiliers, who had a depot at Kinsale. The paper trumpeted the safe return of local landlord Morgan D. O'Donovan of Lisard House, just south of Skibbereen Town. You can see him here on your left. Apologies for the quality of the photo. And the paper published a lengthy report on the banquet held in his honour at the Island Valley Hotel in the town, replete with a guest list painstakingly annotated with honours and titles. The death of Queen Victoria in January 1901 was unsurprisingly given extensive coverage in the paper. As you can see here, this is the front page. The digitised copy on Irish Newspaper Archives seems to have kind of whitened out the black borders, but you can see there's a thickness there which would indicate that there was a black column. So the paper also Potter also wrote a number of valedictory editorials which described her as, quote, Victoria the Good, quote, a truly great personage, quote, and the world's greatest sovereign, quote. Her succession by Albert, or King Edward VII, was thrown into doubt at one point due to ill health, and a series of issues described the successor's condition in some detail before relief was expressed that the King presumptive was fit to attend his coronation in the summer of 1901. Yet this loyalty was far from universal, and Potter was unafraid to turn the paper against the Unionist government of Salisbury for its recklessness. This he could do with some chutzpah, given his reputation. It would be too much to say that the eagle under Potter frequently contained the rantings and ravings of a man suffering from an early form of cognitive dissonance, but it is no exaggeration to state that his views were stridently and earnestly expressed, if contradictory most of the time. After its founder's death in 1906, the eagle passed into a control of a consortium that included solicitor and land agent Richard Doherty of Bandon and solicitor Jasper Travers Wolfe of Skibbereen, who you can see here on your left. Other shareholders included Hugh Flynn, a fish merchant with extensive interests in West Cork, Cork City and Liverpool, John P. Walsh, and also Francis Fitzmaurice of Dunmanway, solicitor and land agent who was killed in the infamous Bandon Valley killings of 1922. Changes in technology were introduced, including the installation of a linotype machine, which Potter had famously detested and railed against in a number of editorials around the turn of the 20th century. A second paper, the Cork Chronicle, was started, but quickly dropped due to the expected revenues drying up. A challenge from the Clonakilty-based West Cork People was short-lived, but its incorporation into the weekly Cork Weekly News signalled a challenge to the Eagle's lair. The editorship was shared by the managing director, R.W. Greenfield, James Topping and local man John O'Driscoll. During this time, the Eagle shifted its perch into the constitutional nationalist camp, but kept a critical eye on the activities of the IPP and supported the deeds and misdeeds of William O'Brien, champion of the Wyndham Land Purchase Act of 1903. That the paper championed O'Brien was significant, as it demonstrated that Conservatives in general were much more supportive of peasant proprietorship, as envisaged by Wyndham and the Land Conference, than the model advocated by the IPP. Furthermore, the bird made its nest in the conciliation tree and was downhearted at the rejection of the Irish Council Bill in 1907. The second decade of the 20th century, from an Irish perspective, it need hardly be said, was a time of turbulence and violence. It began with the Eagle migrating to the nest of the All for Ireland League, William O'Brien's new political vehicle. There were multiple reasons for this, one being that John P. Walsh joined the AFIL and unseated Edward Barry to become MP for South Cork in 1910. Amongst other business interests, Walsh was a director of Allman's Brewery in Bandon, whose trade was hit hard by the liquor taxes imposed in David Lloyd George's controversial People's Budget of 1909. Ringing protests chimed from the Eagle Watchtowers in Skibbereen and Bandon against this diminution of trade and industry in the paper's hinterland, which would also have hit advertising revenues of the paper significantly. This shift in favour of the alcohol and brewing industry would no doubt have sat very uneasily with Potter had he still occupied the nest, as in the years prior to his passing, he had churned out on a frequent basis editorials and articles decrying the plight of alcohol abuse, or the drink curse, which supported the periodic crusades undertaken by the Catholic Church against the demon drink. O'Brien's febrile relationships with those with whom he had shared seats in the House of Commons was highlighted during the Home Rule crisis of 1912 to 1914. For its part, the Eagle took a somewhat detached view, scrutinising the bill upon its introduction at Easter 1912 and offering frequent commentaries on its progress or lack thereof. When it became apparent that the AFIL were not going to offer anything like the imagined opposition to the hegemonic IPP and its affiliate organisations, which by this time included the Border Éireann wing of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, the Eagle softly yet perceptibly shifted its position towards what it saw as a more acceptable form of accommodation, that is, Redmondite loyalism. John Redmond's time as chairman of the IPP had, until 1910, been characterised by stagnation, infighting, and little, if any, progress along the path to self-government for Ireland. This changed somewhat in 1910, as the IPP were left holding the levers of power with the Liberal Party and its allies dependent on their votes to continue in government. Given, however, the entrenchment of the Conservative Unionists with their brethren in Ulster, consummated by the new Tory leader Andrew Bonar Law, a volte face à la Parnell in the mid-1880s was unlikely. The Board of Éireann utilised the introduction of national insurance into Ireland in 1911 to bolster and deepen its power base in the country, so any question of its parent party severing its ties with the architects of that legislation was rendered null. Redmond, however, began to conceive a form of Dominion Home Rule as a method of gaining support among the more trenchant members of the Loyalist community. This was a minority taste, though, possibly even more so than O'Brien's, quote, 3 C's method of bringing all hues of blue on board. Nevertheless, the cudgels were taken up by newspapers such as The Eagle, keen to keep its loyal readers on board. This new brand of green loyalism, as it were, sought to accommodate Catholicism, nationalism and imperialism into a new framework. Redmond had previously given support for a federal system of devolved government for certain regions within the United Kingdom. Yet the question remains if he was supported as much in practice as it appeared in speeches and addresses by many of his supporters. Much of the enthusiasm for empire and keeping the imperial connections seemed predicated on a parity of treatment, that is, keeping Ireland as an integral component of the UK. The Home Rule Bill did not make this clear, and, allied with the complications blighting its passage on 3 occasions between 1912 and 1914, disillusionment and apathy seemed to grow. A consequent growth of extra-parliamentary methods did not much trouble the Eagle as much as its counterpart, the Star, which championed the Irish volunteer movement. A looming civil war seemed probable, if not inevitable. Only events which had barely merited a mention at the foot of one column in an issue of late June 1914 prevented it. World War I shifted the contours of loyalism in Ireland, as newspapers such as The Eagle trumpeted the involvement in the war by Ireland as a quid pro quo for self-government within the empire. During the war, and you can see here some of the various coverage of the war, there's an editorial there about the coming European war. There's some war news there at the start of August 1914. I mentioned Allman's Brewery there a while ago. There's an ad for Allman's Pure Pot Still Whiskey. And here is one of the early photographs printed by the paper, which is a group of Irish National Volunteers from Skibbereen at a rally in Loch Inne, just outside the town, and most of them are named. So during the war, however, constant editorials argued for the measure of self-government to be implemented as a means of saving the empire from a financial burden and also as a bulwark against a threatened invasion from the Central Powers. This was exacerbated by the constant reports of German submarine activity and the fears that agents were operating in West Cork. Recruiting meetings were well publicised, though by 1916 the paper opined that the government should just, quote, leave the farmers alone and target cities and large towns for new recruits, end quote. Shadows over the landscape of loyalty grew darker as 1916 progressed. The Easter Rising was decried by the paper both from an imperial standpoint and also from an Irish standpoint. The government had abrogated its promises to Ireland, and thus such a violent outburst was understandable if inexcusable. What is interesting as one reads the coverage of the Rising in its aftermath, and in this respect the Eagle printed a column-length list of people with West Cork connections arrested in the aftermath of the surrender by Pearse and his colleagues. So what's interesting when you read the coverage is how dissonant it is. The most perceptive journalism in the pages of the paper came from its Cork columnist, the Republican and Socialist Tighe Barry, whose observations and acuity make his column entitled Neath Shandon Steeple a must-read for students of the post-rising landscape. Barry's column, actually, a lot of historians think that it started in the Southern Star in 1918. In fact, it was in the Eagle from mid-1916 onwards. So there's 2 years prior to that in the pages of the Eagle. The death of James Gilhooly and the subsequent by-election in West Cork in October 1916 was covered with resignation, as if the paper and its new editor, Patrick Sheehy, had accepted the death throes of its vision of constitutional nationalism within the empire. This was swept away in 1918, and a new conservative landscape came into view. For its part, the Eagle defended the status quo fitfully during its violent final years, when its offices were raided by both the IRA and Crown forces, and its printing presses smashed. It was the latter that convinced Jasper Wolfe, by now the sole proprietor, to cease publication in 1922. The company limped on, fortified by its printing contracts with various local government bodies, until 1929, when Wolfe, by now an independent TD in Doyleairn, sold the remaining business of the company to the proprietors of the Southern Star, who adopted the moniker the Southern Star, incorporating the Skibbereen Eagle. This moniker persists to this day on the masthead of the paper. And as you can see, the masthead in the Eagle was of a bird in full flight, whereas this one is a bird grounded. So make of that what you will. So just a few concluding thoughts. Provincial newspapers in Ireland at the turn of the 20th century, argued the political geographer Jim McLaughlin in 2001, were busily engaged in building a sense of nationhood among populations severed by geography. In this respect, a nationalist intelligentsia of sorts was created, one which depended on the weekly newspaper to bolster its sense of identity and community. People liked to read about branches of the organisation which they belonged to themselves, passing similar motions or debating similar themes. This accounted for part of the hegemony exercised by these papers in the spheres of politics, economics, culture and society. Not only did these papers transmit cultural and political shifts, they were themselves powerhouses of economy, able to command a readership attractive to a certain cohort of commercial business. They were thus able to construct an imagined community of sorts, a community where people attended religious services frequently, attended political rallies, sporting events, entertainments on an almost nightly basis, purchased goods and services from reputable and trustworthy suppliers for their homes and businesses, and kept a local society and economy going. For its part, the Eagle did all of the above, albeit in a different way. From its foundation up until the death of its founder in 1906, it preached to a world of conservatism, prudence and loyalty. Loyalty to a person's place, loyalty to businesses, loyalty to the agents of government, loyalty to the unitary state composed of a number of nations. Its imagined community was one of agricultural shows, poor law union meetings, petty sessions, quarter sessions, winter, spring and summer assizes, technical instruction where available, and news of deeds done on foreign soil in the name of Queen, later King, and country. From 1906 to its closure in 1922, the Eagle feathered a changed nest, though one that was no less loyal, a nest made up of district councils, county councils, GAA matches, Gaelic League, Éireachtaí agus Scríochtaí, meetings of the All for Ireland League and the United Irish League, and of course, court reports of all shapes and sizes. As a member of a small select group of alternative press based in a market town in a prominently rural and relatively isolated part of Ireland, the Eagle flew high from its watchtowers, surveying and keeping a beady eye on a landscape of loyalism that shifted, fluctuated, and eventually disappeared. Thank you very much.